Okay. Looks like that's all who's coming in. I'm Barbara Collins, and among other things, I teach microbiology. And I cover that and virus in that class, and also when I teach general biology for the majors, we cover, have to cover the whole everything. But anyway, it's sort of interesting. First, I'll mention a few little things about infectious disease, and that's that would be basically that for virus. 1900, it was the number one cause of death. 1980, it was the number five and short cause of death. So it's interesting, it was around the 60s or 70s, sometime around then, that we're developing antibiotics, you know, we take those for bacterial infections, and vaccinations, and all that kind of thing. A lot of people deciding, even the Surgeon General, that, we're on top of it, and in guessing that by the year 2000, we have it taken care of, no more infectious diseases. So many of the schools closed their Department of Microbiology. And in reality, the year 2000, it's back number three cause of death. So the thing is, not only the same old ones, but we've got new ones. We call them emerging infectious diseases. In fact, there's a whole journal I subscribe to on emerging infectious diseases. So it's a whole new thing. What's happening? Why? A bunch of reasons. Number one, we're going into areas we've never been before, you know, chopping down the tropical forest and all that. So we're exposed to new organisms and bacteria and virus. Secondly, we travel. A lot more travel than we used to have, and someone ill over here, you know, and transport the bacteria. Another thing, resistance. The bacteria becoming resistant to our antibiotics, our antimicrobials, and that. And so back for coming. And then, of course, the inevitable mutants. As all you need is one mutation of a bacteria, for example, that's resistant to whatever you're using. It's unharmed. You clean out the others, but he has no competition. And pretty soon, you've got the whole story, the resistant bacteria. Globalization, all these things would be reasons for the emerging infectious diseases. Couple things about bacteria, the growth of them, can be astronomical. If the conditions are right, they can double and in as little as 20 minutes time. In other words, you could start with one resistant one, 20 minutes you got two, 40 minutes you got four, eight, 16, 32, 1,000, 2,000, then pretty soon 1 million, and you're doubling 2 million. You can see, and within 12 hours, that whole population bacteria resistant. In growing that I mentioned in the eye-opener, the bacteria basically need three things, not different from other living organisms. They have DNA, RNA, just like we do. They're just a little smaller. And they need food, but they don't need much. Just dust landing on water is sufficient for many of them. You don't need a lot of food. You don't need that much. Moisture they do need, and yes, as we do, and an appropriate temperature. So, if you want to stop the growth, you use a refrigerator. You make it cold, you stick them in there, and they slow down the growth. If you want to stop the growth, you stick them in the freezer. When you pull it out of the freezer, though, they can start growing. So they just need the right temperature. Moisture, we can dry food, dry milk, dry whatever, and bacteria land on it. The amount that land on it is going to hurt you. They're not going to grow because there's no moisture. So you go backpacking and bring dry whatever and so on. Once you have the water, of course, then they can go to town. But just otherwise. So food, they don't need a lot. Some other interesting tidbits on bacteria. How many of them are there?
No.
Okay. I got some stats here. They outnumber all other forms of life. So there are a lot of them. don't line them up one by one. And trust me, they're really tiny because we have to have a special microscope to see them. We have 1,000 magnification. Even then, you can barely see them. And they're really teensy tiny. And if you were to line them up, although it's very easy, end to end, says it would reach the end of the visible universe, 10 billion light years away. So, and in your body, there are 10 times more bacteria than cells. So, they're ubiquitous. They're around everywhere. And ready to start reproducing when the environment is right. Chuck Gerba, he's, as I mentioned before, he's sort of a funny guy. He's from the University of Arizona. And he does a lot of fun studies on bacteria in the household. And he has umpteen students working for him, so he can publish easily. And they go around with swabs, swabbing the toilet seat and all around. And and he talks about areas where you have the most bacteria. And most contaminated areas of body fluids. Percent positive that you get a positive with a bacteria. Daycare centers are at the top of the list, 45% positive. Bus travel, 35%. Gyms, 28%. Swimming pools, 14%. Restaurant, 14%. Work, 11%. And the doctor's office, 10%. So you're not quite as bad. So, anyhow, yeah, the reason I say he's sort of crazy is looking for E. coli and in the kitchen, and I'll mention some things about that. But he named his first son, would you believe, Escherichia. And in case you don't know it, you probably heard of E. coli, you know, the hamburgers and whatever. Okay, E stands for Escherichia. So this poor kid had the name Escherichia. And they said, guess what he went out in his Halloween costume looking like? Wow. We're thinking his wife probably planted out in the second kid. I don't know if he would probably have been Salmonella or Vibrio or who knows what that is. But, and he had the kid, Escherichia, instead of a colon. Okay, among other things, though, rather surprising, they check, you know, when you flush the toilet, check the aerosols, and surprisingly, some of the E. coli does come up into the air. So, moral of that story is, don't store your toothbrush next to the toilet. So, we've done all sorts of fun things, because I've been teaching for 18 years. And the students are doing senior research projects. So we check the toothbrushes and location, all sorts of fun things. So it's not a good idea to keep your toothbrush right next to the toilet. If you need it in the bathroom, have it on the other side. That would be good. I keep my toothbrush in the kitchen. There are problems in the kitchen too, but I think we would save it. And we've done studies too on the toothbrush, how do you store it? Some people actually put a cap on it, and not desirable, because again, that thing, the bacteria need moisture. Mm-hmm. So if you keep it moist, there's going to be food, you know, you've been brushing your teeth, and there are going to be little scraps or something or other on there. They don't need much. You keep the thing moist, and heaven knows what's wrong on your teeth. And so it would be a good idea to keep the toothbrush sticking up so it will dry in between usage, and not be clamped in a case or anything like that. So those are some other little tidbits. Some people dip the toothbrush into a scope or some of those things, and we'll talk about those in a bit, how effective they are or not. One of the worst things in the kitchen probably is the kitchen sponge, and secondly is the kitchen washcloth. And we've done some experiments on that, and using the same sponge for a period of time, you can get, eventually reach your peak, but I don't think you want to reach that peak. Amazing increase in number of organisms. Particularly if the sponge remains moist between uses, because you're cleaning off the counter, and who knows what's been on the counter, you never reach off of this map. or you have meat or whatever. And if, you know, you could squeeze it out, it's pretty hard to get a sponge completely squeezed out. Then if it's wet between usage, you can get a large number of bacteria in the sponge. There are things you can do, and I'll mention that. Dishcloth is a little better, particularly if you dry it between uses. Again, is that problem moisture? It's a bit of food. So if you can dry it completely, so a thin washcloth is better than a thick one. Don't use a thick washcloth, because that will retain the moisture and the bacteria along with it. So your bed is a flimsy one you can buy in the supermarket for cheap, and you're better off. And you can easily throw the washcloth in the laundry. You know, but the key is to let it dry between. We compare different kinds of sponges too. Those with a, you know, some of them have a scrubber thing on the back that's sort of hard. Those collect more bacteria than the regular sponge. And the reason being because it holds in the moisture with that resistant thing on the top. That's the only kind of sponge I use, which sounds strange, but I always line it up here and never use it unless it's completely dry. Let it dry as long as possible. So actually, I only use it like once a week, maybe if that. But if it dries completely between uses, you're probably reasonably safe. It remains moist. We found a much higher content of that kind of sponge than the other one. There's some directions on what you can do with a sponge here. You can look on the web. It says here, probably one of the better ways is to microwave it. You can run it through the dishwasher, but I don't know how well that works. Bleach you can use, but it says not as effective as using the microwave. To microwave it, you moisten it completely, and then microwave. It says 1 to 3 minutes, and I guess it depends on your microwave. I think I'd go for 2 minutes, and I guess you can begin to see smoke coming up and lighting up. I don't want to think of that. So those are possible things to do if you really love a sponge. I purposely don't. Kitchen sink. We did the 5-minute rule, you know. And if I were to drop a hunk of food here on the floor, I'd probably pick it up, maybe look for hairs or anything I didn't want to eat, blow it off, and I might go ahead and eat it. If it were, you know, a table or something like that, I'm not going to worry about it. Again, it's the same thing, dry, no food. And if my food that I'm dropping is dry, I'm not going to pick up much. If, on the other hand, I'm picking up something wet, wet objects pick up bacteria much more readily, then maybe question that. So where you don't want to drop your food and pick it up in 5 seconds or less is the kitchen sink, because that's wet. And Chuck Gerber says that's the worst place in the kitchen, is the kitchen sink. And as the and then there's a question about food left out. Not good. Because you got moisture, you got food, you got the right temperature, bacteria are going to go to town. I always tell my students about the Sunday school picnic syndrome. Okay, it's midsummer. We're heading out for a picnic, Sunday school picnic, you know. Mom wasn't feeling too well the day before. But anyhow, so she's making the potato salad that morning. I'm cutting up the potatoes, you know, they're pretty warm. And mixing the mayonnaise and some egg and stuff. And then to keep it, keep the flies off it, she puts saran wrap over the top. Then they head out in the car. It takes about an hour to get to where they're going. Okay, so that potato salad has been incubating for an hour. The saran wrap keeps the hold in the moisture and keeps it nice and warm. You know, it's in the back of the car. And then when you get to the picnic spot, the guys want to play ball. And so everything's laid out on the table nicely for the little bit of sun. The saran wraps over it to keep the flies off, right? And so they play ball an hour and a half or so, and everyone comes back starving and helps themselves liberally to this potato salad. In about 3 to 4 hours, on the way home, kids aren't feeling too well. And pretty soon, the whole family is not feeling too well. And, you know, it's the Roto-Rooter disease. Throwing up and out both ends. 24 hours, usually the most unpleasant. So that's my Sunday school picnic recipe. So again, it's really important to refrigerate your food and to, you know, prevent the bacteria from growing. There should be no problem.
Would that be multiple types of bacteria? Or
what I'm alluding to there is probably Staphylococcus. Staphylococcus food poisoning. There are different kinds of food poisoning. There's salmonella food poisoning you can get from raw chicken juice, or eggs, raw eggs. So theoretically, you're not supposed to, you know, you make cookies and the raw eggs in there. Gotta be careful with that. Probability of staph or salmonella being in the egg, you don't know, but you're playing Russian roulette again. Not that you're going to die, but salmonella food poisoning is a lot more unpleasant than staph. Staph, you're over in 24 hours. I mean, you're weak, obviously, but it's generally over in 24 hours. Salmonella usually lasts a week, and intense abdominal cramps, may have a fever associated with it, and that goes on for a week with diarrhea. And that can be unpleasant.
It was always thought that it was the mayonnaise that was the trigger in, you know, any kind of potato salad, macaroni salad, or whatever. And I don't know whether it's propaganda from the mayonnaise companies or what, but there was also then, you know, a counter to that that said, you know, it's not the mayonnaise.
Well, actually, the woman making it, people carry staph.
That's
and a lot of people carry staph aureus, which is the cause of it. And see, she's making potato salad. She's using her hands.
Right.
And it's going to get the staph just from her hands. And different mayonnaise will match a little different. If it has a lot of vinegar, it will help to inhibit the bacteria. But depends on, you know, what you're using. But probably the staph initially came from the woman in that case. Yeah. Because we all carry staph. A certain percentage, about 30%, carry staph aureus, which does cause disease. So those would be examples of that. Okay. E. coli. I might mention this a little bit about that. You probably heard of the 0157. That's the one that you get really ill from, and that was a jack-in-the-box one a long time ago. People got ill and several died, and causes a hemolytic, it attacks the kidney and the poisoning. And rather interesting, in other words, we're warned never to eat raw hamburger. And yet, growing up, we did.
Sure.
You know, what's different? There is something different. And a couple of things. They're less careful in the slaughterhouse, for one. But there's an interesting study done indicating that what they feed the cows now is a big factor. Because to make the cows grow rapidly, they feed them grain. Grain in his digestive system causes rapid fermentation, and so there's a lot more acid produced. So, in other words, the bacteria, which would be fecal, and when you're not being careful about how you're, the slaughterhouse, if you get some fecal material in with the meat, you know, it's all ground up, particularly hamburger, then you could get E. coli there. Okay, that could have happened in the past, but if you, in the past, they didn't feed the cattle the grain, instead they gave them alfalfa, you know, the grass and stuff. And the fermentation doesn't occur that you get that much acidity. The long and the short of it is that the E. coli then is very resistant to acid. Okay, your stomach's very acid. Bacteria resistant to that, they're going to go right on through to the intestines and then cause, you see, your diarrhea and ultimate problems. They were suggesting whether this would ever happen. Is that farmers would at least the last 2 months before slaughter. Do not use any grain, use only the alfalfa so that bacteria would not be resistant to rancid. So that's one of the, at least one of the theories on that. So you have to be very careful. Chicken, the same thing, can have salmonella or E. coli. We found both, and that you must be very careful handling raw meat, and that you thoroughly clean tabletop too. Or now get to plastic boards versus wood boards. Then I'll talk about what's the best way of cleaning too. It's important that you clean the tabletop where you're cutting or with meat as much as possible. You can buy these little wipe things with Clorox, and that can be useful too to keep to help remove the bacteria. We've done a bunch of experiments and checking what's the best way of removing bacteria. They have the kids in the lab. This is just one of our regular lab experiments. You bring in some dirt, they dirty their hands, and brush them off, yeah. And then I have different ways of washing to see which works the best. Okay, so one way is water alone, air dry. You know how you go in these restaurants, have the best. Then the second way is soap and water a little bit. The first way, I said, you know, like your kid, you know how the kids are, you just go in and air dry. Then the second way would be soap and water, better job, air dry. Then we tried the same thing using different drying methods. So we used the water again and dry with a cloth towel, soap and water with a cloth towel. And then we used just plain water, paper towel, soap and water, paper towel. Okay, the worst, no matter how you washed your hands, was air dry. The best, I forgot to tell you our favorite one. Water, dry them on your pants. Or number two, soap and water, dry them on your pants. Believe it or not, that was better than air dry. Reason being, if you don't wipe the bacteria off, they're there, you know? Soap and water, obviously better than plain water, but if you're not, big thing is removal. Okay, now those were our experiments, and wiping on the pants wasn't that bad. Depends on how often you wipe them. Usually at the end of the experiment, it was getting a little shaky, but at the beginning, and the cloth towel again, too, initially worked great. But at the end, I didn't even want to bring the thing home. I'd stick it in a plastic bag and throw it in the washing machine. Because by then it's wet and grimy, and oh my gosh, what is on this one now? So, you know, a dirty towel that's been wet with everyone's hands on it. And so, reminds me one time, my kids tell a story on Rachel. She was down visiting some friends, and the mom wanted them to wash their hands before dinner. Well, my daughter, I think she did the water job without the soap, and then dried them very nicely on the towel. But then the mother comes in and accuses the poor husband of getting her towel all dirty with his grime. And Rachel, knowing that it was her dirty required as a towel, definitely needed one.
Did you try it with hand sanitizer?
Yes, we did. And interesting results, and I'm going to do more with that. This is really fun. I send a student out, also, and we're going to do more on this to find out if a person uses the sanitizer a lot, do the bacteria become resistant? Okay, I used it, but also there's a study, scientific study, that was published probably about a month or 2 months ago using norovirus, and which is the one that causes the most common causing diarrhea and the 24-hour flu or whatever you want to call it. And they found that using the sanitizer did not remove the norovirus. The most effective is just plain soap and water, paper towel. You have to wipe it off, they found, was the most effective. And again, it's the removal. We had tried, what we do is this, with a different bacteria, as sort of a fun one of our early experiments, I smear bacteria on here. We do two different kinds. One is what we call gram positive. That would be like staph. The other is gram negative. That would be like E. coli. Okay? We're covering different kinds of bacteria. Bacteria we divide into two groups. Gram positive, thick cell wall. Gram negative, thin cell wall. Alright? But either can cause disease. So we smear bacteria all over here. Then we put discs. I have them bring in, check their favorite disinfectant, whatever, and we check to see how they work. We try hydrogen peroxide. We try alcohol, the 0.0 alcohol. We try Purell, you know, the sanitizer. We try soap, you know, or Listerine. See how they work. I have kids bring it. We also, what's that? It'll come to me. Neosporin. Let me put that one in.
Neosporin.
You've all heard of that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you a little bit about that too in a bit. Anyhow, if the substance works, this would be, we impregnate a little filter paper dish with one of these substances. If it works, you will have a ring around there that the bacteria don't grow. Remember, I smear the whole surface with bacteria. Don't let them grow yet. I put the discs on to see whether it will inhibit the growth of the bacteria. Okay? And then we incubate it to see the bacteria grow or not. Okay. Hydrogen peroxide. That's H2O2. You get a nice ring. We always do. Beautiful. Alcohol. Frankly, nothing worth writing home about.
The brand of alcohol.
Correct. That's about the same. Doesn't really kill them. And so, Listerine, they're about the same. Hot alcohol in. And Neosporin, nothing. Neosporin is supposedly an antibiotic. You've heard of antibiotics. What are they? They're substances of biological origin. We get them from living organisms, okay? And we have used them. And penicillin was the very first one. And then you have neomycin, streptomycin, you know, vancomycin, a whole bunch. Okay. And I can tell you how they work. But at any rate, Neosporin's been out on the market forever. All right. Even the guy, Fleming, is the guy who discovered penicillin, sort of by accident. But then they had to work with it so that you could concentrate it. But he even predicted that bacteria will become resistant to it. And sure enough, they are. And so we have to keep looking for different ones, oxacillin, methicillin, and all of those to try to combat this resistant problem. If you use it long enough, there's bound to be an organism that's going to become resistant to it. And if it's continual use, there's no self-respecting bacteria that isn't resistant to it. So that's why I really don't think waste your money on these for you. Might as well use Vaseline, a lot cheaper if you want the moisture. Your best thing, if you have a wound or injury, if it doesn't need stitches or anything like that, a scrape. The best thing is maybe you could get iodine is very good as a disinfectant. You could use some hydrogen peroxide or whatever. But your best thing is sun and fresh air. Let it get dry as much as possible. A Band-Aid is not your best friend. Some of my worst infections have been because of a Band-Aid. Think of it, a Band-Aid, what's it going to do? Unless you have perfectly cleaned your wound, which is unlikely, you're sealing in the food, the moisture, and your bacteria. Nice temperature.
they're going to grow. So you got to be careful with Band-Aids. If you do have to wear them, like on your feet and stuff, that's fine. But take it off when you can and let your wound air. Swimming pool with chlorine is wonderful, you know, and lay out in the sun. So all those things will help healing. In the old days, we used to wash sheets and hang them on the line and in the sunshine, and that would be very effective. And because we've even done dishes, shallow dishes, impregnate with bacteria. Keep one in the dark and one in the sunshine, and the sunshine, very effective healing. So those are different ways of, easy ways of killing your bacteria without a lot of strong things. Okay, what about the antimicrobials? Maybe I'll mention how the antibiotics work. You're taking them internally, so you don't want them to hurt you, and yet you want them to hurt the bacteria. Well, how does that work? Bacteria have a cell wall. These guys. Here it is. The bacteria have a cell wall. Here. To the outside. Some of them have a thick cell wall, and this guy has a thin one. This guy has a thick cell wall. Some of the penicillin attacks the cell wall of bacteria. We don't have a cell wall on our cells. No problem. It's not going to bother us. It only attacks the bacteria that need that substance for the cell wall. And so, bacteria don't grow. That's what you want. So, penicillin is one of those that prevents one of the substances, muriatic acid, from getting into the cell wall. So, no cell wall is formed. So, penicillin works very nicely against staph, unless, of course, the staph has become resistant. And you probably have heard of MRSA. Staphylococcus aureus, methicillin resistant. Methicillin is one of the side ones they make from penicillin. Methicillin resistant staph aureus. It's resistant to a whole bunch of antibiotics, but it's not. Methicillin, oxicillin, a whole bunch. And very, very problematic because we are running out of antibiotics to do. To look for. We've got vancomycin, but that's about it. And if it becomes resistant to that, don't have anything else. Very, very real problem. And why is this developed? Because of overuse of antibiotics. In the past, they used to give antibiotics for virus infection or patients demand it. And antibiotics have no effect on virus. They don't have a cell wall. Another whole bunch of antibiotics work on what we call ribosomes. They're essential for protein production. We have ribosomes. Bacteria have ribosomes. However, there's a difference from ours. There's a smaller, a different. So when we use streptomycin, tetracycline, chloramphenicol, those attack the ribosomes, but the bacterial ribosomes, not ours. So again, they work without harming us. There can be side effects, but basically the principle behind the antibiotics is that we attack something on the bacteria that we don't have. So it'll kill the bacteria, but hopefully not attack us. Fungi, fungus cells are a little bit closer to ours, a little tricky finding something that will attack the fungus, not us. So we don't have as many antibiotics for fungi. These are some little tidbits. Those of you who like your coffee, I think Chuck Gerber went around checking coffee cups that have been sitting around, you know, and 20% tested had fecal bacteria. I thought that would be interesting little tidbit you might find now. Okay, I need to tell you what viruses are, then we'll open the floor for any other questions. Viruses are non-living. Bacteria are cells, they are living. Viruses are non-living. And why not? Well, no cell,
and we consider the cell the basic unit of life. That if they have DNA, you've probably heard of that, or RNA, but not both. We have both. All living cells have both DNA and RNA. The virus don't. Cells are non-living. They require a living cell to be able to reproduce. But reproduce they can. Remember, the bacteria in 20 minutes go to double. 2,000, 4,000, 8,000. Virus have a way of them. We've learned most of what we know about virus from those that attack bacteria. The reason being, we don't like to be killing all the animals off by checking but learning about the virus. I mean, they use them maybe later, but who cares if we kill a bunch of bacteria? No one gets upset, and we can learn a lot about virus by studying that. So, there's a funny little virus called a T4 phage. Cute little thing here. Looks like something that might land on the moon. And has some DNA in there. And they did some interesting studies to find out what the virus does. It literally shoots, that's DNA, that's the hereditary material, okay? Literally shoots the DNA into the bacterial cell. Then, genes on that DNA cause all the activities for E. coli, that's E. coli, to stop for producing E. coli and go to work for the virus. So, in about half an hour, you are getting, first you get a whole bunch of replicas of the DNA, then you also produce protein coats. Got the genes for that too. And you assemble these little virus in there, and in about a half an hour, 200 of these new babies come out. So virus infection can go a lot more quickly than a bacteria. And you're probably aware of that, you know, cold. Sometimes they can take over like people. So the bacteria, that's the end of them, because the virus causes the bacteria to rupture, and out they come, all new little guys, ready to infect. Okay, so that's the story of the virus. They're non-living, but they do have to have a living cell to reproduce. Okay, what virus are you familiar with? Obviously, measles, the common cold, and so on. Rabies, a few others. HIV is another one. And we study that. It's a little different shape. Spherical. Actually, not spherical. But it has a shape like that. With the, happens to be RNA instead of DNA, but it has an outer envelope, a little bit different. And on that are little things here, that are little, the proteins. And on our cells, we have receptors for those things. Two little name for that, GP120. But anyway, on our cell, we have some receptors for that. And so, it attaches to our cells, and we say, oh, welcome. And we invite them in. And so, in comes the HIV. What happens next? The protein coat is removed. The RNA enters, actually, into the nucleus and hangs out there. The chemistry produce babies that then come out and again reproduce, and they can come out of the cell. Depending on the cell that the HIV virus attacks, it may or may not rupture the cell, but at any rate, you're going to cause severe problems. When it, certain of the cells, it will, T cells, which are the ones that we use for combating infection. That's what it infects. So it's a very insidious kind of thing. The virus attacks the cells that normally are supposed to attack it. And so within our cells, you see you have this virus reproducing, rupturing those cells. And so our T cell count will ultimately go down. When it gets to a certain point, that's when you have the condition known as AIDS. And
then condition is not good. In other words, your T cells have reached such a low point that you are really not capable of attacking. So it's a gradual, slow progression down. Could be 10 years. Now that we have the drugs, it prolongs that, but still you have that gradual loss of your T cells. Okay, I'm going to close now and see if you have any questions.
How about going back to the
bacteria?
Places of bacteria, yeah, and you talked about kitchen sink. And what about the faucet handle and doorknobs? People often don't think of those.
That's one of the problems in a restroom is the doorknob. Because if the person before you has not washed their hands, we go around swabbing doorknobs, of course. And probably one of the worst things, though, that we go swabbing are the computer mice and the keyboard, particularly in a public area like the library, or if you go to a store like Best Buy, where everyone's handling that. We get suspicious count. Oh, let me tell you about house flies, too. We did a fun experiment there. But anyway, handles. And the problem is, this is why I object to these sanitizer, those air blower things, because like you go to a restroom, and they don't have paper towels, right? And so you wash your hands maybe with soap and water, but who has the patience to stand under those things and have your hands particularly dry? I always dry them on my pants before I go out, because if you have wet hands, you will pick up more bacteria. Now, some people, if there is a, perhaps the smarter thing would be to have the wastebasket outside the door so you can use the paper towel. But sometimes I think we're a little bit, too phobic about germs. And another issue here, we overuse the antimicrobials. Soap and water works as well as anything. It's better, emulsifies the bacteria. Use a paper towel or some kind of towel preferably, and much better than using antimicrobials. Because another study done with the antimicrobials, they are thinking that in some cases can lead to resistance of bacteria to antibiotics. But those are concerns. Yeah.
I was talking to some people in Spokane that had gone to dental hygiene and different healthcare schools and stuff, and they did the same thing you do with your students and stuff. And the one thing that really caught my eye for some reason was a lady's purse or handbag. And when they go to the restroom, where do they put them? They put them on the floor. And then where do they put their purse when they come back to their workstation or back to their home? They put them right where their lunch is, or maybe where they have some croutons or something they're eating while they're working on their computer, in the bottom of the purse sitting there on the desk. I thought that was kind of really an eye-opener.
Again, depends on what the purse was sitting on. Because if it's a totally dry floor, as I mentioned before, the number of bacteria on different objects is amazing. I have my kids count the number of bacteria in one of our first layouts is, after they learn how to deal with the bacteria. We count the bacteria on alfalfa sprouts. We count also on soil. I use store-bought, just plain old. I use organic alfalfa sprouts. Alfalfa sprouts from Dr. Collins' pure, pristine kitchen. And then we count soil. Okay, they have fun because, you know, my alfalfa sprouts, how are they going to come out? I use, usually when I'm preparing for them, a bag method because I put the seeds into a mason jar, add water, cheesecloth thing, you know. And I don't change the cheesecloth. That's mistake number one. So I get a pretty high count on my alfalfa stuff. But nevertheless, I could be a little higher, but I'm right up there with organic or non-organic, very high, 500 million per gram, and a gram is only two or three of those little sprouts. Whereas on the other hand, we check soil as only a fraction of the number of bacteria. Plus, the bacteria on alfalfa sprouts could be harmful. They're mostly gram negatives, and little shaky what they could be. Soil, they're all gram positive. Nothing else can land on the soil. You wouldn't find staph there. Well, how would it get there? Because that would be more in humans. And you'd be better off. And then instead of putting alfalfa sprouts in your sandwich, put a few grains of a dirt there. You'd be healthier. A little gritty on the teeth, and I don't know about the digestive system, but a number of bacteria would be a lot less. So you can put your sandwich on a rock. Even if there's a little dirt on, it's not going to hurt a soul. A little dirt, blow it off, eat it, no problem. But I haven't used, oh, I can never get the kids, you know, we've got the alfalfa sprouts. Never gotten a kid to bring the alfalfa sprouts home and eat them. And I'm not going to eat them, so we have to throw them out, these great alfalfa sprouts. But I haven't eaten them since we started counting the number of bacteria.
Are you saying that antibacterial liquid soap is not worth the money?
Exactly, I'm saying that. Just regular soap. No regular money. We did another study, this was last summer, from the PE department. They had purchased at an extra expense antibacterial towels. Okay, so we cut those up and then we used the regular towels and smeared them, washed with E. coli and staph, and found that, and then checked them. No, it did nothing. It was exactly the same as the regular towel. And as Chuck Gerber says too, and your washing machine doesn't always remove everything, so there are some residue there, but chances are it's not going to hurt you.
Doesn't make you excited when you watch somebody clean off the top of the table in a restaurant? You put the same old rag on everybody's table and stick it there.
As long as the table gets dry, I don't worry too much. But if it's still wet, then you might raise an eyebrow.
We hear so much about staph infection in hospitals, particularly, and they're working very, very hard to control this.
Absolutely.
What is there anything new coming out? I mean, they've instituted all kinds of
What they're doing in our hospital is to checking people even for MRSA if you're going to be admitted. And that can be helpful. Another problem, too, another one that's just coming up, I don't know if you've heard of it, Clostridium difficile. That is another really one that's just up and coming, causing severe diarrhea, particularly in healthcare facilities. Reason for that is when you take antibiotics, they kill not only the bad guys, but they kill the good guys. You have in your body millions of bacteria, but most of them are doing a good job. They're keeping out the bad guy. If you remove them, it leaves empty space for slow-growing bad guys to come in and take over. And one of them is Clostridium difficile in the intestines. Severe problem because it occurs when people have been taking long-term antibiotics. And then very difficult to get rid of that.
Is this cyclical or is it? You get it, and then you have a period of time when you're okay, and then you get it again?
Well, with the Clostridium?
The diarrhea?
I'm not sure about all the symptoms of that. I'm not sure. I know it's been a serious problem.
Given what you've said, I'm curious. I barely survived a MRSA infection 10, 12 years ago.
How long ago?
10 or 12 years ago.
Okay.
And since then, my dentist has required that I take 400-500 milligram tablets of Oreomycin an hour before I make my appointment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does that jibe with any research that you've done?
Nothing that I've done. I guess the concern is try to get them before they start growing, I'm guessing. Because once they start growing, then you've got the problem.
It's the business of somebody else's hands and instruments in my mouth that could trigger it. Mm-hmm. But I've never been able, I guess, because if I got MRSA again, it was likely I wouldn't survive.
Another thing, too, that another study has been done concerning animals. They can carry it. and can transmit it to humans. Another study, this occurred in a journal in which this family, the woman would have MRSA come in. They would finally get it under control. She'd go home for a few days, and she'd back again. And they finally found that she slept with the dog, you know, and they're very close, but the dog also had it, and so she'd come back. And so they finally had to treat the dog before they could finally get rid of it. Mm-hmm. So animals can carry staphylococcus. We have one of our students who's now in veterinary school studying that.
And MRSA is like other staph.
It's staph, right. It's staphylococcus aureus. The only difference is it's highly resistant to many antibiotics.
But lots of people carry it.
People carry staph aureus, but not necessarily MRSA.
Okay.
And in other words, it's not necessarily that resistant to all those antibiotics. But interesting too, we also check water, you know, just water going into the ocean and stream water, and found, looking for E. coli, but a similar situation. And once we got the E. coli, which was not too difficult, checking in, we do this also at school, check for antibiotic resistance, and in most cases, a resistance to at least two, sometimes three antibiotics. That's just water running.
Something that probably wasn't even resistant to.
Pardon me?
Probably something that came out of the stream that probably hadn't even been in contact with anything.
Right, right. Well, one of the problems is in animal feeds, they give the animals antibiotics. And so, obviously, any fecal material from them is going to be resistant.
Getting in the stream, that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah. So those are problems, too. One more question.
We see a real effort on the part of lots of pediatricians to not over-medicate young children,
right,
so that this is hopefully going to be better for them in the long run to not, you know, not totally be resistant again to overuse of antibiotics.
Because in the past, you know, we just get off the pills, you know, you got a headache or whatever. And, to limit, because that's one of the problems of resistance, is too free use of the antibiotics. And one of my students did a study in Mexico, and there's very little limitation, you know, just pretty give it out and be problematic. So these are concerns, definitely. Okay, I think that's about it.
Thank you.
So,